think we are getting there. It says preparing.
Okay.
All right, I think we're live. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. It is Angie Atkinson, and I am here with the lovely and talented Dana Morningstar. Dana, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Always happy to have you. In case you're new around here, you will be interested in knowing that we do this dual stream every week. We try to. On Tuesdays, we alternate channels. So we come to this channel this week. Next week, we'll be back over at Dana's channel, which is Thrive After Abuse, right here on YouTube. And she's also findable at Thrive After Abuse around the internet, including thriveafterabuse.com. So make sure you subscribe to both of us and hit that bell notification to be notified when we do these streams. Okay, wait a minute. I'm hearing myself talking. Not good.
Okay.
Here we go. All right. So while we're waiting for everybody to pop in, I will just really quickly let you know what we're going to talk about today. And as you might see by the title, it is Narcissists and Sex. This is a sort of taboo subject here on YouTube, but we are feeling like it's an important thing to talk about. So we're just going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, everybody. So Dana, do you want to start us off today? Or
sure. Well, you know, I think this is a topic that I think a lot of people, when they come to our channels or support groups or whatever, they're looking up information, mm-hmm. how their former partner is in bed is something that they're trying to figure out. And so it tends, from what I've noticed, it tends to fall into kind of two main categories. Either their former partner was a terrible lover and very selfish in bed, just to a point of, you know, incredibly hurtful, cold, cruel behavior. Or it's the opposite, and their partner was absolutely fantastic in bed, and they're having a hard time moving on from that because it feels like, boy, we just had this amazing connection, not realizing that this narcissist was perhaps either putting on a show or they were just hypersexual by nature, and it's not the same as having amazing chemistry with somebody.
Right. And I think maybe you kind of mentioned this in the first one, being cold and cruel, but I've seen also in fact, my ex-husband was this type, the one that would rather have sex with oneself. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's this, or they just are asexual, or they seem to be. Whereas with my ex, he would, you know, reject me, and then I would catch him handling his own business later, or immediately after in some cases. Or he would, and then of course I thought that was all me. I found out later it wasn't, but mm-hmm. at the time I was just distraught. But so there's that as well. And then I've also experienced the other end of the spectrum where there's the hypersexual situation. And if you don't perform as directed, then you're, you know, threatened. They're going to cheat. They're going to this, they're going to that, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I've heard from a lot of clients and people here on YouTube about the sex addict situation. Have you?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of an ongoing issue. Hello, everybody. So I guess what I think is important for a lot of people is when you go through, and let me just add one more thing. There's also there are those who have the strange kinks, and mm-hmm. like whatever you're into is cool, but sometimes they pressure people into things that maybe they aren't as interested in. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Or maybe things that aren't comfortable for them and things they don't want to do. And And I can say that a lot of people have, talked to me about that as well.
Yeah. Same here. And, you know, I think when you have somebody that's more on that narcissistic side of the spectrum or further, like kind of narcissist, malignant narcissist, sociopath, psychopath, kind of into the spectrum, it's all about power and control. It's a very domination-driven, ego-driven personality disorder. And that tends to go hand in hand with abuse, because abuse is all about power and control.
Yes.
And sex is oftentimes just part of that. So there really isn't that level of like sincere intimacy or sincere connection, even though they can feel like it. It's just another form of an abuse of power. And what I've seen a lot of, and this is maybe kind of some fringe stuff, but there's quite a few out there that are really into like sadism.
Yes.
And inflicting pain and suffering on other people sexually and otherwise, verbally, emotionally, physically, you name it. And it's heartbreaking, because then when the survivors of these relationships, they get out and then they start realizing, oh my gosh, it just makes them almost physically ill of how much they tolerated, thinking that they were being, a relationship takes compromise, and they're kind of being this good partner. They're trying to stay open-minded and they're being flexible and all of this stuff. And really their partner has gotten off on their pain and their suffering and eroding who they are.
Yep. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. And it puts people in a really difficult, because you love this person, you think this person is your soulmate or whatever, or even if you just like that person, I think what happens, there are actually different books and websites and things that will actually teach someone how to make a person bend to your will for their particular sexual kink, right? And I've seen these, and I understand, I guess, they're not actually trying to make someone do something they don't want to do. In most cases, they're trying to teach someone how to, convince someone to do what they want. And again, I just want to say, like, whatever you're into is fine. I'm not trying to judge anyone. Unless you're a pedophile, then I'm totally judging you. But outside of that, I just am. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no reason to apologize. Yeah.
But outside of that, I mean, I really like, as long as two adults or however many adults are consensually involved and having a good time and safe and whatever, fine. But I think especially with people like narcissists, sociopaths, psychopaths, we're looking at people who they see other people as objects and extensions of themselves and different things. And so they do a lot of things. Another thing I think that might surprise some people is that, and this is part of how they hook us in the beginning, is that we see those narcissists who come in hot and heavy. Like you said, they're amazing in bed. They are very generous, if you know what I'm saying. They tend to, enjoy seeing themselves succeed at, pleasuring you at the beginning or whatever. Mm-hmm. Of course, that changes over time. And like you said, I think some of them then kind of, and then there are those who just stay good in bed, but they're just terrible everywhere else. Right. Mm-hmm. But whether we're male or female, we can obviously be addicted to good intimacy. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing. But a lot of them do enjoy the idea that they're the best in that area. And I've actually heard narcissists say, I plan to control this person with sex. And I think that's insane, but it really does happen. So, And then you've got those who say, this is the other side of the coin, right? So sometimes you'll see a narcissist who meets a person who is sexually adventurous, let's say, or who is normal adventurous when it comes to this kind of stuff. Maybe they like a certain type of position or whatever. And the narcissist will come in and be like, listen, I am totally into all of that. I'm totally into whatever you're into. Let's do that. And then of course, once they're actually in the relationship, that ends and that person feels rejected or like they lied to them. And, so I mean, there are just so many. And then of course, the criticism issue. Have you ever tried to tell a narcissist about something they were doing wrong in bed or something that you didn't like they were doing? And then of course, narcissistic injury and right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yep.
Yeah. So I don't know. Let's see. Is anybody? We have a lot of people.
And just like back to the hypersexuality thing. I think this is, if there was one theme having to do with sexuality that repeats, I'd say number one would be hypersexuality and just the level of cheating and promiscuity.
Yeah. I see a lot. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But I would say almost, maybe not as many, but a large percentage also on the other end of that spectrum, where they are withholding, or they're punishing by withholding, right? And this is not just women, because a lot of people would assume this is only females, because, you know, the stereotype is all men like to have sex.
Right.
But there are many men who do, you know, who, like my ex-husband, he was great until he just, you know, withheld and cut off and did his own thing. So I don't know exactly what his issue was, but I kind of do, but we don't need to get into all that today. Let's see.
Or kind of along the lines of that withholding, or they're having sex, but there's no intimacy involved. Like there's no kissing, there's no eye contact, there's no foreplay, there's no thought to the other person. It's very much selfish sex. It lasts until completion. And even for men that have had more of the female narcissist, they feel like a sex toy.
Yeah.
And there's just this feeling of being used, and there's a lot of hurt that goes along with it. And of course, normal, decent people tend to think, communication can solve this, right? Yeah. So I'm just going to keep talking to my partner about it. I'm going to keep bringing up my concerns. I'm going to keep trying to get through to them, to get them to realize that it's not okay that they cheat, or it's not okay that our sex life is absolutely terrible, and they're horrifically selfish. And, you know, things, of course, don't change.
Right.
So
yeah,
is that person's just not emotionally available.
Right. Exactly. You know? Yeah. And it's really painful when you're in that relationship. I remember feeling, and let me tell you something, when I was married to that person, I was much younger and much hotter, and I'm not trying to be funny, but I really was. I mean, I was slimmer, I was much younger, and I just, you know, so I wasn't, I mean, looking back in hindsight, I could see that I was attractive, and so it wasn't about me, and I was definitely open and receptive, and also I think other people would have been happier in that relationship than this person was in that way. But he was so self-focused that he did love bomb me with the good stuff, you know. But once, I mean, I remember, okay, let's talk about this really quick. For those who have been pregnant, this person, when I was pregnant, this person made me feel like the most disgusting thing on the planet. Now, to be fair, I'm not attractive as a pregnant woman at all. But like my current husband, he was much better. He was like, you know, I think he was pretending, but he told me that it was sexy to him at that time. And I mean, he seemed genuine. But from the first time when he was almost visibly disgusted by the pregnant belly and all the, you know, stuff, it was very painful, and it really it destroys your self-esteem as a person, you know. And I'm sure that others have experienced similar things. I don't know, let's see what people are saying in the chat here.
Yeah. And while you're looking for some comments about that, I'll just add to, you know, I've seen you know, just back to that level of selfishness and cruelty, when they're with male narcissists, the female narcissist is, or a female partner is pregnant, you know, cheating, excessive cheating when she's pregnant, being on the phone with somebody else during labor, feeling put out and inconvenienced when she goes into labor, demanding or pressuring her for sex shortly after a C-section or a vaginal birth. You know, I've heard horror stories of women that have had to go back to the hospital because of complications from surgery, because their partner was pushing them into having sex. It's just the lack of regard is just jaw dropping.
Yeah, truly. It truly is. Yeah. And now Kathy says, yeah, I did things that I was uncomfortable with. I think she says even paid, but I'm not sure what PD is here, so for uncomfortable acts. He told me those acts were normal. He used guilt trips, coercive control. Yeah. And that's really, truly, coercive control is a good term, and that's exactly mm-hmm. what you're dealing with. Because I did things in one of my toxic relationships where that were way above and beyond what I would have ever thought I should probably stop. They were things I wouldn't have normally done, and things I was very uncomfortable with, and I wish I didn't do. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I still to this day have residual sort of trauma around those things, you know? And I think because it's such an intimate act, because it's something, it affects us in a way that's different than any other sort of abuse. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And even though we say, you know, okay, we'll do it. It doesn't really mean that we really want to do it. It's not, I wouldn't say that it's rape per se, but it sort of resembles that on some mm-hmm. level, even if you're, you know what I'm saying? Like it's, so I think coercive control is a really accurate term.
And I think that a lot of the residual trauma that people have surrounding that, it's because they feel like there's so much confusion about it. Like, well, but I agreed to it, or I allowed myself to be talked into it. And instead of realizing, you know, this is coercive behavior, and any type of agreement obtained under coercion is not an agreement. So in a lot of states, that is considered rape.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and I think you're right. But I think it's most of us don't go and say, hey, this happened to me. It's embarrassing. It's shame. We feel, you know, it's tough. Okay, so Nance says, it's so painful to look back over my life and realize what went on sexually and what I put up with. Please share how to heal from all of this, as it was an area that I thought being submissive was pleasing. And we will definitely get to that as well. I think one of the things, I want to pick up a couple other things really quick here. Nance says, and that is what you do when you love someone, which is true. But again, high factor 11, first time making it to a live session. Again, I think that's accurate. Nance adds that she was looking for approval, which we all were, mm-hmm. I think, and spot on the intimacy part about it being more painful. Yeah. And that's, all of that's true. And Tim says that's the only asset they have and they know it. So Nance, I want to come back to the healing part, but I want to address Tim's comment really fast. he says that's the only asset they have and they know it. And I think in some cases that is true. I see this with both men and women. I've seen it with women especially, but also men, because everybody enjoys intimacy when it's done right, or most people. But women, I've seen a lot of, not all women who are narcissists are like this, but those who are of the histrionic type especially, I've seen them, it's almost, I know one person in real life who's like this, and it's almost like watching, it's almost like they're some kind of, they have a strange power over people in general. And this particular thing, in the case of the person I'm thinking of, they don't actually enjoy the end result. They just like all the attention and the drama that leads up to that part. And I found that to be rather interesting. and I wonder how often that is the case with these types of women. But what are your thoughts? I'm just talking and talking.
I just wanted to point out, well, here's a comment from Channel Tools who says, well, gosh, my ex never did any of this. Maybe he's not a narcissist. And I feel it's important to discuss, you know, this level of pathological self-absorption comes out in many different ways. Sex tends to be a main one for a lot of people, but there's a lot of narcissists out there that do remain faithful, or that just aren't that interested in sex, but their selfishness comes out in other ways. So a person doesn't need to have all of these traits in order to be a narcissist. And we're not even trying to say who is and isn't a narcissist,
of course.
So I guess just kind of realize that, 'cause I see this a lot where people are like, oh gosh, well, my ex didn't do that. There was no emotional abuse, or like there was no, there just wasn't any support. right? So there was more like neglect. There wasn't active abuse, there just was neglect. And then they kind of won, and then it kind of goes on to, well, maybe they're not a narcissist, then maybe it's not a problem, or maybe I'm the problem, or maybe this could have been saved. Maybe I should give them another chance. And yeah, that's my concern, how that train of thought tends to continue. And problematic behavior is problematic behavior at the end of the day. And it's important that we figure out where our breaking point is with what we will and won't tolerate in our life.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a valid point, that absolutely, I can't disagree, because, excuse me, because what I think what people don't think about is exactly what you're, good points. Okay. Tim says that he literally caught her in lies and she continued to lie and had a blank stare, that thousand yard look or whatever. And I think, and Tim is also the one that said that that's all they had to offer. And yeah, wait a minute. I want to come back to what you said. I'm just so sorry. Okay. Yeah, I think it's important for people to recognize exactly what you said, that they don't have the ability, we can't assume that anyone is or is not a narcissist based on this aspect of who they are. But there is such a thing also as like a sexual narcissist. And I don't know, I think that would just be a regular narcissist. but what I think, and I think that's just like a pop psychology term, sexual narcissist. You tell me if I'm wrong on that. But I think one of the things that, I think a lot of people do that thing where they, well, this person doesn't do that, maybe they're not a narcissist. And like we've said repeatedly over the years, labels aren't as important as how they make you feel. So that's the thing I wanted to pull out of all that. Okay.
Yeah.
Verse Harmony says, I was practicing with her exploration and caught on prior, but gave the benefit of the doubt. I saw it mostly because of additional claims of abuse, et cetera, people as people, even who carry narcissistic traits. I'm not sure. Okay, so I think this person, I think First Harmony is saying they weren't aware of what this person was doing until they like heard from other people, maybe, or they caught on beforehand because of other people, which makes sense. Been surviving for years. Yeah.
And Crystal Mountain makes the comment, when I first was pregnant with a narcissist, the narcissist was all about how he got me pregnant. Nothing about us becoming parents and being responsible for a growing adult in society. Mm-hmm. And this is such a great comment, because I've heard many different variations of this. I had a friend who was married to a guy who, I mean, textbook narcissist. Oh my God, that whole situation was beyond infuriating. And he had cheated on her multiple times. And I'll never forget, it was her birthday and we'd all been drinking and she had had way too much to drink, so she wasn't really coherent. And he had somehow, I don't even know how it came up, but had made the comment that the thing that he was most proud of in his life was making 5 babies. And wow. Yeah.
I mean, I could see being proud of your children or having children, but making 5 babies?
Making 5 babies, like get, and 2 of them weren't with her. It was basically that he was able to get women pregnant a total of 5 times. And it was just so dehumanizing and just vile. But I've also seen this. I there was a patient that I had years ago, and I think this is more common for like younger guys, but it's all about how many women they could knock up. And it's not uncommon for these guys to have 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 15 kids
and by, not pay for any of them, I'm sure.
And not, oh, of course not. Yeah. Because it's not their fault, right? You're the women are the greedy if they want them to actually pay.
I'm always shocked by that, but it's really true.
Yeah. And So there's that level of disregard and how cruel and uninterested they can be in the child too. Yes. Is also jaw-dropping. I think there's so many women especially that think, oh, well, women, probably women and men, once the baby comes, this person will be different. And then they're horrified and just their jaw just falls on the floor. Like, how can you treat an infant like this? Like, how can you physically abuse an infant? How can you just let it sit there and scream? How can you just not care? This is your child. And they don't. It's sort of like, it's like the whole Chris Watts thing. You know, it's, I enjoy having kids when I want them, but as soon as they kind of get in the way, I'm okay with throwing them away.
Yeah.
Because they're slowing me down. I'll just make more.
It's, yeah, yeah. It's something else. I remember with my ex, when my oldest son is from my first marriage, and when he was born, I'll never forget. I had to go back to work really quickly due to money or lack thereof. He didn't make very much. And I didn't have the type of job where I would be paid on maternity leave at that time. So I went back to work after 4 weeks. I was supposed to be out for 8 or 12. I had a C-section, a really terrible one. But anyway, that's another story. Anyway, and I remember when I left him, we didn't have phones with cameras at that time. This kid is now 23. But at that time we had a digital camera, and I would find pictures on the digital camera of where he would dress up. At one point he would dress up the kid, the newborn and the 4 week old baby or whatever, and take photos of him screaming. Or he would take photos of him screaming, and I would come home and he'd be like, see, this is what I had to put up with the whole time. And then as he got a little bigger and started to walk, we moved into a small house, and he ended up blocking off half of the living room and turning it into like a giant playpen sort of. And then he would, when I would leave, he would just put the kid in the playpen or the giant half of the living room or whatever. And he would literally not, I went through this crunchy phase where I was doing cloth diapers, and they were the kind that had the snaps and everything. Anyway, I had purchased like a bunch of them, but one of them was different than all the rest of them because it was like a sample one or something. And it was like a natural color instead of white. Right. So it was like kind of tan. Well, one day before I left, I put him in that diaper. And when I came back, he was in the same diaper. And I knew for sure because it was the one that was different than all the rest. And we had to send them out for diaper service and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I remember, and he had horrible diaper rash. I mean, it was a cloth diaper, you know, it was like a terry cloth diaper with a wrap around it, you know, and I would find out later that he was throwing food, like little baby crackers and stuff he was never letting him out of that little room.
Oh, wow.
While I was gone. So I never left him alone again, obviously, after that. But it was just about a month later that I left and stayed away after that, you know, divorced him. But
yeah,
it was shocking. Yeah, it's shocking how little they, you know, and this child looked exactly like him. There was no question, you know, that this was his child. But the only time he would have anything to do with him was to, you know, show him to people, look, this is my baby. And then he'd act like such a good dad in front of other people. But then the minute we were behind closed doors, he'd have nothing to do with him. He wouldn't change a diaper. He wouldn't, you know, get up with him in the night, nothing. And so like, I don't even know. I think I slept about 3 hours the first 3 years of that kid's life. But anyway, so yeah, that was rough.
Yeah. Their level of, just the lack of regard, level of selfishness is just staggering. I've seen guys, I've heard stories where, you know, they'll have the baby. And of course, you know, seeing a dad with their baby is very endearing. And a lot of women are like, oh, you know, you're so great with your daughter or your son or whatever. And it's, you know, and he'll play the part of like, oh, I'm just this really super involved, you know, dedicated father. And then he might even make up a whole story about how he separated or whatever. And he's basically using the baby as a prop to help him get laid. It's it's disgusting. It's
My ex still does that from what I've heard.
It's just shocking.
It is.
Nance also mentions part of her question too, She says, I could never understand how he could cheat on me like he did when I was submissive and do whatever.
I've said this to a lot of people, and I've even said it, I think, in a video. You could be perfect in every single way that there is to be perfect, and you could be the ideal person for a narcissist. Like if they could have picked you out of a catalog, but it doesn't matter. You'll never be enough. And it's not you, it's them. You know, they yeah. need external attention. They need, I think a lot of them have this low threshold for boredom. And I don't know if it's ego related or if it's, I think sometimes the cheating is ego related. I think sometimes mm-hmm. it's related to that inability to entertain oneself or the need for new things all the time. I know one person who needs that new relationship feeling all the time, you know, and that causes that person to cheat. I think it just depends on the individual and their brand of narcissism, if that makes sense. Do you have thoughts on that, Dana? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree. I think people cheat for a wide variety of reasons. It's probably one of the biggest like misnomers out there that people tend to cheat just because there's relationship problems. And that really bothers me. I feel like that's something that's really frequently missed in therapy, is it's treated like, oh, this person, instead of like, well, maybe it's a character defect. You know, like, let's look at that. Maybe this yeah. person doesn't have a moral compass and they just don't care.
Right.
For a wide variety of reasons.
Right. And they'll make you feel like it's your fault. But
oh, absolutely. Especially yeah. if they get caught, then they turn it into, oh, it's a we issue. Mm-hmm. You know, well, it's because you gained weight or you lost weight or you dressed too sexy or you didn't dress sexy enough or you worked too much or it's whatever. They'll try to blame their bad behavior on somebody else because they can't ever fully, sincerely be accountable for it.
Right.
And
they can't. Yep.
Yeah. And so, Nance, what you're saying, I've seen this a lot, especially in the like, BDSM community, where people, and that's so, oh gosh, that stresses me out so much because it's just extra dangerous because here you have people that are intentionally exploring and pushing the bounds of power and control. And that can be dicey even within the healthiest relationships, but it really requires open, honest, sincere, solution-oriented communication and a very solid, like a huge level of trust, and like a really healthy relationship before any exploration of power and control and boundaries or experimentation can appropriately or respectfully be navigated. Because without that, then you have people falling into roles of, okay, well, I'm dominant and you're submissive, and so therefore you do everything that I say. And you have a lot of people that are submissive that are maybe submissive for those reasons, Nance, where they're like, okay, well, I'm going to earn his love or her love. I'm going to do everything sexually. I'm going to fulfill every fantasy. He'll never leave. And the reality is, no, it doesn't work that way, because there is no earning love from a narcissist. It's, they're just instant gratification. It's in the moment and it's all about them. And you know, so exploring, again, a healthy relationship, if there is this exploration of whatever it might be, you know, role playing, wherever on that spectrum things might be, there has to be, okay, well, what are you okay with? Are you okay with this? You're over communicating about things because, you know, like this, you know, both people really need to be okay with what's going on. And it's okay that in a healthy BDSM relationship, it's the submissive partner that has all the control.
Exactly. It's
not the dominant one. Yeah. So the submissive right. one is able to say, okay, you're really into tying up your partner. I'm not into being tied up. Okay. Then it's a no-go. Right. It's not trying to push the submissive person into letting you get there. Now, the submissive person might say, down the road, I might be into it, but right now I'm not.
Right.
And that dominant person needs to respect that 100%. And if not, if they're not doing it, then it's abuse. And there's a lot of abuse that's going on in this community that flies under the radar for a lot of people, because they're not separate. They don't realize, like, but this is our role. Like, I agreed to be submissive. I agreed to get spanked and slapped and to sleep in a cage and serious, like all kinds of, to all kinds of degrees. And they're not realizing that, you know, you've always had the power to say no. And right. This person, especially if you get tangled up with a dominant person who's been around the block a few times and really knows how to manipulate and twist things, it's just, it's messes with the person's mind at a whole different level.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. I actually, and I think that's the thing people don't realize, is that there is a healthy, if that could, you know, a healthy type of BDSM relationship, or a healthier type. And one thing that I've seen people do, I have a client who's actually part of this community. And one thing that I've done with her is I've had her make a contract for her relationship as she started a new relationship. So both parties could be in agreement. And she was, but she's very aware of her power as a, you know, a submissive in this situation. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't normally necessarily want to work with someone like who was being actively abused in that way. I'm not, because I'm against them, but because I feel like they need a different kind of help than coaching. Mm-hmm. But in this case, because I understood that she was fully aware of exactly what you said, herself being the one who really holds the power, and that giving herself, submitting is in itself a kind of power. I worked with her, but she did a contract, an actual physical contract with her person. And I thought that was really healthy and positive, if you, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, Nance was asking about, well, how do you kind of move forward and heal from this? And I would say that's a really good first step, is to understand where our power and control is. Is it inside of us, or is it somehow outside of us? And this is one of those things, you know, we're not taught, nobody's taught this, unfortunately. And it's very rarely role modeled appropriately, and it's not discussed. So until, you know, a person maybe crawls into therapy, or they crawl into a life coach's office and they're unpacking all of this. So I think so many people get tangled up in all kinds of problematic situations because of this, because nobody talks about it and it's not taught. Right. So, you know, a big part of healing from it is being aware of where your boundaries are and realizing that it's okay for you to say no, and that a healthy relationship must involve boundaries. Yeah. It must involve boundaries.
Absolutely.
If boundaries don't push people away or keep them away, they bring them closer, because then you're engaging with them in a way of respect.
Yes.
But we have to know where our boundaries are and when they're crossed in order to maintain that ebb and flow with that other person.
Absolutely. And now, to add to this, Marley asks, what happens after you've become accustomed to this? Are you broken? And what I would say is that, you know, the term broken is debatable. Are you damaged? Yes. But that doesn't mean you can't heal. It's not, you're not irreparably broken almost ever. I mean, obviously there are extreme situations where, you know, you can become just completely emotionally unretrievable, maybe. But I really believe that with the right focus and the right kind of help, almost anyone could recover and have a comfortable existence, if not a happy life after that. Mm-hmm. So no, I wouldn't say you're broken for life. I would say maybe you're going to have a hard time. But I sort of got used to it. But I kept trying. I would go, you know, this was back before everybody had the internet in their house, but I would keep trying. I would keep reading books. I would go to the library and I would get books about how to be better at this stuff and all the things around this stuff. And it didn't matter, because that person, I went so far as to do all these like surveys of this person and all of this stuff. So like, what a joke. I'm so, you know, looking back on it, I'm almost embarrassed to say that. But it honestly, what it comes down to is that I could have been his perfect person and it wouldn't have mattered. And I wasn't his perfect person, although because I was not Japanese. I found out later he was also not Japanese, by the way. Anyway, okay. So Karen, congratulations, is going no contact on the 4th of July. Freedom. Smart, smart. Factor 11 says, I went no contact so far for 3 weeks. It's been a ride for sure. Congratulations. And I'm so glad. I had to get very demanding. He was looking for ways to stay in my life. I made him come get all of his things, but I just did not want anything that he can use to reach out. He was a verbally abusive person and made me feel like an alien. Yeah, Factor 11, I can absolutely relate to that feeling of being made to feel like something's wrong with you, you're not normal, etc. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the gaslighting stuff, I think. Congratulations to you and to Karen for going no contact.
Yeah, and changing my life makes the comment, you know, I usually only realized my boundaries have been crossed afterwards, not while it's happening. And I would say that's normal. I think part of healing is kind of closing the gap between kind of when our boundaries are being violated and our awareness of it and how we're handling it.
Yeah.
And so kind of that first stage tends to be after the fact reflection. And it might be years later where we realize, oh my gosh, my boundaries were really pushed. They were violated. And then the more we get in tune with this, the more we realize, oh, okay, actually this happened today, like 3 hours earlier, my boundaries were crossed. Now I'm starting to really realize that that was indeed a bigger problem than I was allowing myself to realize at the time. And, you know, narrowing that space. And and with time and practice, we can get to the place where we're able to be assertive in the moment and handle these issues because we're aware right away, like, ooh, that doesn't sit right with me. Like, I'm not okay with that. And I need to say something.
Yeah.
And I can say something assertively and not aggressively.
Yes. It's a tough balance.
Long road.
Yeah, it is. And it's something, you know, I can't say I'm perfect at it at this point, but I'm definitely better than I used to be with standing up and putting the boundaries in place. And with also, you know, there are things you can do to sort of, you know, depending, like in business, for example, I would have certain people that would take advantage of different ways of me in my business. And so I hired a bulldog, a person who would come in and not care what those people thought. I don't mean it like that. A person who wasn't afraid to be aggressive if needed. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And not in a negative way, but just in a, so that my boundaries weren't continually overpowered way. You know, it was draining me. And not to say that I can't do it myself, but it's, you know, for any former codependent, I think it's hard to sort of disappoint someone or make a person feel in some way like, you know, anyway, it's hard to not let ourselves be taken advantage of if it feels uncomfortable. Yeah. And so I can do uncomfortable. And I know that, you know, the more healed I become, the more aware I become of the need to sometimes let it be uncomfortable. And that's, I think, what enforcing boundaries does to most of us is that during the initial effort of said enforcement, we become uncomfortable because they, especially if they're a toxic person we're trying to enforce a boundary with, and even if they're not, if they've always been allowed to do X, Y, Z, and suddenly we're like, no, that's really not okay with me. They're like, What?
Yeah.
That's how it's always been. And so you have to be willing to be uncomfortable for a minute to push through that because, my gosh, on the other side, it's a beautiful thing. It's so much better when you are able to enforce your boundaries and you feel so much more powerful. And so, like, just getting through that few minutes of discomfort, in my opinion, is what really gives you the power to recognize, okay, it's worth it. So if you haven't tried it yet, set a boundary and be willing to be uncomfortable for a minute and see how it goes. maybe not with a narcissist because they don't care about that, but maybe with a healthier person.
Mm-hmm.
But you can with a narcissist as well, but you can also be prepared for rage and injury, you know, narcissistic rage and narcissistic injury, where they act angry. And if that doesn't work, they act sad and pathetic, like you victimized them, you know?
Yeah. So. And it's, you know, you bring up a great point, Angie. It's difficult if we're not certain about our boundaries, standards, deal breakers, is that appropriate? Is it appropriate for us to be able to say no? If we don't have a real solid footing in that, it's so easy to get pulled off center, mm-hmm. by manipulative people, because they do a great job. I mean, they oftentimes are sincerely outraged.
Yes.
You know, what do you mean you won't watch my kids this weekend?
Yeah.
You know, I always watch your kids.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean you're saying no, you won't loan me money? I'm your mother. Yeah. What do you mean you won't do X, Y, and Z in bed with me? I'm your husband.
Yes.
Don't you want to make this relationship work? Well, gosh, Sam's wife does X, Y, and Z, and I think you're just prude and you're just uptight and mm-hmm. this, that, and the other. And so it sort of starts planting seeds of doubt, like, well, is it me? Like, am I being unreasonable or what have you? And so it's really important to realize that your boundaries are your boundaries. Everybody's boundaries are different, mm-hmm. and nobody else needs to agree with you.
Right.
Okay to be that lone voice in the room where you're like, well, everybody else in this room is totally okay with loaning you money and, you know, having threesomes. I'm not okay with that. And that's okay.
Yep.
That doesn't make me wrong. It just means I'm not interested in doing that.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you brought up a really important point there. And that is that the one thing I want to pull, first of all, everything you said, 100% accurate. One thing I want to pull out of it is this thing about so-and-so's wife will do it, or everybody does it, or whatever. And this, you know, bringing back around to the topic of sex, this is one of the coercive tactics they'll use sometimes to, you know, because I think a lot of us have this, first of all, because we're insecure about who we are, and a lot of times they put that in us, even if we didn't have it before,
mm-hmm.
We doubt ourselves on every level. And so now what they're doing by telling you that, you know, Tom's wife or whoever's wife is, they do it. Well, now every time you see that woman, what are you going to think? You know what I mean? You're going to think about that, and you're going to think she's better than me because of that, or she's sexier to my husband or my boyfriend or whatever because of that. And so then you struggle. So I see this a lot of with, you know, and sometimes they'll say real, I really think it's, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but they, you know, we know they isolate us to push us away from people who might support us, right? So here's an example. My best friend came to my house she was the maid of honor of my wedding, my first wedding. And my ex, like, kind of acted weird and flirty with her in ways that made me, you know, little subtle things that she didn't really notice, but I was aware of because, you know, it's the dog whistling thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
I knew his secret flirt moves or whatever. And one of the things he said to me during that time was something about, you know, do you ever just imagine, you know, do you ever just look at someone and undress them with your eyes and imagine what they look like naked? And they kind of glanced at her at that moment. And it just, the horrible feeling, you know, and luckily I knew she wasn't ever going to be, you know, that type of person. I would never have to worry about her. So I was not, you know, he wasn't able to pull us apart that way, but he certainly tried. And it was bad. my point is, that's another way that they do control you sexually, is by making you think other people in your life are attractive to them, or they know about other people's stuff because it's so-and-so's wife and they told them or whatever, or that everybody does this and you're the only one who doesn't do this, mm-hmm. you know, little things, even certain types of grooming or, you know, certain choices of underwear, you know, little stupid stuff that is irrelevant in real life.
Mm-hmm.
They do. Yeah. And also, of course, that benefits them on the isolation factor as well. I just thought that was important. Have you experienced anything like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. The planting seeds of insecurity and jealousy and,
yeah.
You know, just, yeah. all kinds of stuff. It's difficult.
No
Do you
doubt.
Have any pointers on, I guess, healing from this?
Yeah. And it starts with the recognition that there was a problem outside of yourself to begin with. And it's, again, it's harder when we're talking about intimacy because it is so, you know, it's such a basic human function, not function. It's such a primal need or a primal thing with us, with all animals. And I think for humans, because our psychology gets tied up in it, it's even worse. But it starts with undoing what was done. And so I think it starts with, first of all, acknowledging what you went through and what happened and being aware of the, you know, because during the process, sometimes you're not fully aware of how you feel. Like when I did the things that I wish I didn't do in my previous relationship that were something someone else wanted me to do, during that, I tried to tell myself I was into it and I tried to be into it. And this person would want me to do things to make sure that I wasn't, you know, like read things and, you know, whatever to sort of get me to get into it. And I tried really hard because I loved that person and I wanted that person to be happy. And I felt like if I wasn't what they wanted, they would go find that somewhere else. Right. And so during that, that's what I was doing. Well, then years later, I was like, I recognized, oh my God, I'm totally traumatized by that. And it really, you know, so it took me years to even recognize the trauma because again, I was trying to make that person happy and doing things I didn't like to do, I didn't want to do in order to make that person happy. And so I kept lying to myself in order to make myself be okay with it. And so I think one thing that's really important is that we have to, I had a little piece of fuzz on my nose. We have to be able to acknowledge and truly look at from a different perspective what we were going through and acknowledge, okay, I do have some trauma from that. And starting by saying, you know, starting by recognizing that person during that relationship convinced me that I wanted to do this or let me know that they wanted to do this. So I convinced myself that I wanted to do this and I was traumatized in this way. And just to really put it all out there, because I think recognizing it is the first thing, being aware of what happened and then to take it to the next level, to be able to step by step sort of overcome or understand the depth of it, understand the psychology of it. For me, this has been helpful to understand why they wanted that, why I tolerated that, why I did it, even though I didn't want to do it. And then to the next step to decide to forgive myself for letting that happen to me, which I know sounds silly, but it was necessary for me because I felt so stupid, even though I know I'm not stupid, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I felt so dirty and not in a good way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then to raise it to the next level and go, okay, so I've gone through all of this. Of course, you have to work through the emotions and all of that. And then to raise it to the next level and go, that wasn't okay with me. But it's over now. And now I'm setting boundaries. I'm learning how to set boundaries. I'm taking it to the next level of, so I think understanding, and then part of that process of understanding the science of it, if that makes sense. I like to look at the science behind, or the psychology of it and all of that. And I try to see that from a non-emotional perspective, right? So the first step for me, I guess, then is recognizing there's a problem, recognizing what the problem is and defining the problem, right? And so that is the part at which I recognize, okay, here are some emotions. And then I step back from the emotions and I look at the psychology and I look at the reasons why, and why would I allow that? Why would that, you know, even why did that person want that? And then beyond that, to marry those two things, kind of, to take the psychology and the emotions, the logic plus the emotions, and put them together and recognize, okay, this is where it all ties together. And once you can do that, I think during the period of time that you're working on understanding the psychology of it all and the science behind it, sort of, I like to say, see it like a scientist. And that sort of puts the emotion on the back burner for a minute and allows you to, I don't know if it's the time or if it's just because the two sides of the brain working together or what, but then for me, tying them together is so much easier because if I can recognize, okay, here's a labelable thing that this person did, or mm-hmm. here's a logical string of events for me that led to me becoming a person that would do that, then I can also sort of figure out how to undo it for myself and how to pull away from it from other people, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. I would say my process is very similar, you know, approaching events in my life or my own behavior or both mm-hmm. From a place of curiosity and not judgment.
Yes.
So it's, what is this? Why did this happen? How did this happen? Kind of who, what, when, where, why, and how of it. And from a place of curiosity and not judgment. So not shame, not guilt, not anything. Just being like, okay, this happened. Let's explore this. And then trying, you know, to then kind of, yeah, just figure out, okay, here's where we are. And like, what do you need in order to move forward? You know, to move through that healing. And a lot of it is treating ourselves with grace and compassion. You know, you did the best you could with the information that you had. And even though you might have said, yeah, I'm okay with this, or you were a willing participant, if there was coercion in place, or there was deep manipulation in place, or there was unprocessed trauma that led to you acting out, realizing that these were all factors in your decision, and you know, to give yourself compassion for that. So, because again, this stuff's not taught and it's not discussed, and men go through it too. So it's men and women, this form of like sexual abuse, you know, and guilt and shame and manipulation and everything. Oh, you're muted.
I forgot about that. Yes, I agree with you. And I've seen more than one man do that. I've go through doing things he didn't want to do, or mm-hmm. or allowing things he didn't want to allow in his relationship, both gay and straight, you know. And so definitely.
Yeah, one of the things that helped me move forward was reclaiming my sexuality.
Yes.
So for a long time, especially after my relationship with Jack, I really was in a dark place. I just wanted to hide. I wanted to disappear. I just didn't want to be seen. My mind was a million miles away from sex or dating or having any interest in either. And it was to the point people were like, "Oh, you're dressing so frumpy. I wish you saw yourself the way that we," like my friends were like, "Oh, we see you so different than how you see yourself." And the self-esteem I had at that point could fit in a thimble. I mean, just had none. And I don't know where that came from, but it was just this moment of, I feel like I already lost enough with this relationship. I'm not going to give him the power to take anymore. And realizing that I needed to reclaim my sexuality for me and not wait, not hope. Oh, I hope someday it comes back again. I hope someday I feel like a sexual being. To be like, I'm going to take effort to bring that part back, and, you know, allowed myself to feel attractive just for me. And then I realized I had never done that before. I'd always bought sexy bras or panties or lingerie to wear for someone else.
Yeah.
I had only put on makeup if I was going to see my significant other.
Yep.
I was only doing these things. I was only putting effort into my appearance and feeling attractive if I was going to be spending time with my significant other. And if they weren't around, then I just felt schlubby. And realizing, oh gosh, I can wear sexy lingerie for me and just enjoy it. And then shifting that mindset was huge, because now it's sort of like, okay, all of my undergarments, this is TMI, I apologize, I really like.
Yeah.
I don't have a pile of gross undergarments anymore, you know, like a lot of women do. And I used to, where it was just sort of like, oh, why? I'm just schlubbing around the house. This bra is 14 years old and, you know, or these panties have holes in them and they're, you know, 14 years old or whatever. Now, no. Right. And I intentionally get rid of stuff as it's fallen apart or as it's just not looking good, because I like to feel good and I know what I'm wearing underneath. And so if I am with my partner, then lucky him. Like he gets to experience it, right? Like he gets to experience it. I'm not wearing it for him. I'm wearing it for me because I like the way I feel in this, but he gets to experience it.
Exactly. And I actually went through a similar sort of awakening myself. Thank goodness. You know, and for me, it was interesting because it was always about what he found attractive. And even beyond that point, before I fully healed, I think that was sort of what it was about, what other people found attractive. It's something that I'm learning as I, even now, as I'm getting older, as my style is evolving. And I'm, yes, I definitely want to wear cute things, but I also want to wear comfortable things now. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds funny, but I really do kind of like the glam look sometimes or whatever, but I am so much less likely to be caught wearing something that is physically tight on me or at least in an uncomfortable way. Like I'll wear, you know, certain things that are form fitting, but not, anyway, I went through a similar awakening and it's interesting when you buy something that you think is sexy as opposed to what you think other people would, or men or the opposite sex, whatever, might think is sexy. It's interesting because I'm about to tell you something really funny. Should I? Yes, I'm going to do it. Get ready. This is big. Okay. So one of my things has always been, I have always thought my breasts were too small. And so I've always worn very padded bras. It's true.
Okay.
I know, right? And guess what? Next week, I'm still wearing a padded bra today, but next week I will not be because I have just gotten involved with this. I don't want to say the name of the company because this is hashtag not sponsored, but there's a company I found that is all about comfort and also cuteness. And I have ordered specially sized, you know, so they're supposed to no gap, you know, all the good things fit, straps don't fall down, all that stuff. And so I'm embracing my small breasts and going to wear, you know, bras that actually are not padded. So I'm pretty psyched about that. I mean, maybe they have a little padding, but not, you know, for coverage, but I know that's a funny thing to talk about, but it is something that I was always very insecure about before. And I saw this photograph of myself this one isn't insanely padded like some of them have been, but I saw a photograph of myself with a very padded bra and I thought, what the hell am I doing? That's not even me. It doesn't even look normal. You know? I mean, they're not like micro size, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm, I just always thought they were too small and like whatever, you know, I know people get implants and I'm not doing that. It's not, I mean, like I'm fine with other people who do it and I see why people might want to do it, but that's just not, I'm not a model or even somebody who cares that much about it. they actually worked very well for breastfeeding. But my point being is it's an insecurity that I've had for that. I think, I don't even know if I'm insecure about it anymore, but it got to the point where I just was just always used to buying the very padded bras, you know? And I just one day I was like, they're not even comfortable. You know what I mean? Like, what am I doing? And so I just had this revelation recently that I'm dropping them. I'm cutting myself off. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm telling you that is because we all have something, right? Yes. We all have something. And so whatever that is for you, if it is, I know you're naturally well endowed in that way, and I'm not too jealous, but I'm just kidding. I'm not jealous at all because my back doesn't hurt. Because you know what I'm saying? I have friends who have had reductions and all this. And but, you know, there are benefits to both things. My point is that it's for me, it's kind of like just embracing my real self, as opposed to the self that I tried for so long to show people that wasn't really me. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. You know, and I hope you don't mind me sharing this.
No,
about what
I don't
we were talking
so.
About a little bit before we went live, but we were talking about quarantine and gaining weight and
And
I was telling Angie, I've, you know, gained weight too, and this has got to stop. And one of my biggest challenges has been this time around was like, you know, I was so disgusted with myself when I got on the scale, and I'd gained like 6 pounds, 7 pounds, which is a lot. Angie and I both are like 5 feet tall.
Yeah.
So, you know,
it adds up quick. It
6 pounds or so makes a big difference.
Truly.
And realizing, you know what, I'm so tired of being at war with my body and with myself. And what would it look like if I were to get rid of that old diet mentality, that old, like I'm going to exercise and eat to punish myself kind of a thing, you know, like you slob, like drill sergeant, you know, you need to get out there and run and da 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 da. What if I were to approach myself from love? And what if I were just to love myself healthy and not focus on a number on the scale and, you know, just develop a healthy relationship with food and a healthy relationship with exercise and across the board. And and realizing, God, you know, there's so much of that social programming that we all have about what we should look like. And I would be, and I know men have it too. It's just not as discussed as body issues with women, but all these feelings of insecurity and inferiority and, oh, this person's, you know, got bigger boobs or perkier boobs, or they're thinner, or they're more muscular or taller, or whatever.
Right.
There's a million different reasons to feel bad about ourselves. But at the end of the day, like, you know, I forget who said it, but something along the lines of, you know, loving yourself is an act of rebellion.
It's true.
And it is so true, because society will just keep you down. And there's times recently, even with quarantine and realizing I'd gained some weight, where I went on YouTube and there's a lot of like plus size people on YouTube.
Fashion that do, people.
Yeah. Like clothing hauls and stuff. And I just would sit there I'm not a fashionista, but I'll sit there and I'll watch a lot of these videos. And for a lot of them, I'm like, they just seem so comfortable in their skin. And how can I, you could not pay me to get on camera, let alone the internet, in my underwear or in a bikini. And by societal standards, my body is significantly more socially acceptable than theirs.
Exactly. And, that's,
you know, so it's just sort of like, where does this come from? And what if it wasn't a weird competition? What if it wasn't about, and I'll think too, because a lot of times my thoughts are with some of these women, it's that initial social programming. Oh, that's so disgusting. And I'm not even talking about health. Like, I'm not even going to go there with it, but just that initial revulsion and then realizing, well, wait a minute, where is this coming from?
Right.
You know? And can I put that aside and just appreciate people being people? Because a lot of them, you know, are pretty active and kind of walk a good line between being healthy and living their best life. So
and that's something I know we talked about this a few weeks ago too, before one of our chats, because I had that moment similar to what you just described, where I got angry and I was like, why do I have to do this, you know? And so now I'm trying to love myself healthier again, and I've done that before. I've actually done it in a significant way before, but life is as it is, and well, I'm not perfect. But yeah, quarantine has kicked my butt in certain ways, and so I'm also, you know, yeah, totally with you on that. And that brings us back around to, you know, the that brings us back around to the fact of we have to, you know, I think one thing, if we're going to talk about what's sexy, one thing that I have found is that sexy is, of course, there are some physical components, but most people will find, okay, not most people, healthy people tend to find confidence very sexy, which is part of the problem mm-hmm. with finding narcissists. But I don't mean that type of confidence. I mean genuine self-confidence, not confidence built on the shoulders and necks of other people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So learning to be self-confident in your physical body, whatever shape it is, something that really I learned when I lost all the weight before was I could not hate myself thin or happy. Mm-hmm. And so I try to remind myself and other people around me, you can't hate yourself happy. You can't hate yourself thin or pretty or taller. Damn it. I keep trying. Mm-hmm. But you know, so it is really, truly, you know, when we say love yourself, it sounds so cliche, but it really is truly what it comes down to, when you can learn to, first of all, accept yourself in any given moment. So if everyone here right now just takes a deep breath with me, and I just want you to just tell yourself right now, every single flaw that you have going on, every single thing, positive or negative, I just want you to openly, without judgment, accept it. With me, I'm going to openly, without judgment, accept all of this. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's all. Start there. Mm-hmm. And when you find yourself going, but I hate my C-section scar. I hate my C-section scar. Or I don't like my thighs, or I don't like my small boobs or my big butt or whatever. It doesn't mm-hmm. go together well. Then you aren't helping yourself. You're just, instead of hating it, like accept it. And then a little secret is that you can actually learn to love yourself unconditionally despite all of those flaws. But it all has to start with first accepting yourself and not living in that place of self-hate, self-loathing. Yeah. That's just going to further spiral down into all the badness.
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely. And that's so much where that confidence comes from, is realizing, and that's in that level of self-assuredness and confidence, that's where that intimacy really comes from with yes. another person. And that's what's so sexy, and that's what's so beautiful. It's yes. it's not about the superficial things. It's about truly getting to know another person inside and out for who they are. And that is unique, and that's a deep connection. That's just, it's not there. And right. once a person's able to form that connection with another person, you know, one night stands and, you know, non-intimacy related sex really loses a lot of its appeal.
Yes, that's right.
It's like fast food mm-hmm. when you can have, you know, five something star better. Dining.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. We have a lot of great comments in here, but we are unfortunately very much over time, and I promised I would be an hour today. Angela Falsetta, hello number one. I just want to add this. She says, did we think and believe we were enough in bed? And I think that most of us probably not as much. Anywho, okay, Dana, do you have any final thoughts? We're going to have to get ready to wrap up for today, but we will absolutely touch on this again if you guys want us to. So if you do want us to come back and talk about this again in the near future, let me know, because I'm just being brave and doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I know Dana would be happy to as well. So let us know in the chat or comments. Yeah. Dana, any final thoughts for today?
I guess I just want to underscore your comment about the importance of loving ourselves. And that's the magic in all of this. Truly. That's when healing really starts to happen, is when you realize you matter. Mm-hmm. You matter, and you are worthy of being treated with dignity and respect starting now. And you are there's lots about you that's lovable. And we can start by loving ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you can't do that, start with acceptance. Just accept who you are, what you are, And don't be angry or mad or hate yourself in that moment. Just accept. And when you can, you'll learn to love too. It just, it's a process. People,
I love that. All right. Yep.
Yeah. You kind of taught me that in a way, Dana. We'll talk about that next time.
Oh, okay.
You did. Yeah, the part about acceptance, it didn't occur to me until you made a comment one time. We'll talk about it next time. All right.
Yeah. Isn't that so funny how that happens?
Where
sometimes something somebody will say just really resonates.
Yeah.
And like, I don't even know what you're talking about, but you're like, oh, this was really game changing for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we will cover it, but yeah, totally. All right. Okay. Everybody, I'm so glad that you enjoyed our time together today. We will see you next week over on Dana's channel, Thrive After Abuse. And so make sure you subscribe to this channel and that one and hit the bell notification to be notified of our next session. All right. Thank you so much for being here, and we will see you soon.
Okay.
Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Angie.